As a young man growing up in Texas with a Presbyterian minister father, Andy Douglas never realized that he would eventually be a monk with the yoga and meditation organization Ananda Marga. But in his 20s, he boarded a plane for the Philippines to begin his training. Let's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. It was in Thailand that Douglas, now an Iowa Cityan, realized that East Asia had the spiritual environment that he needed. He writes in his new memoir, "Mystics and activists, these people are drawn to discover what lies beneath the surface patterns of the world." This hour, I'll talk to Douglas, and he'll relate the challenges he faced as a monk living in Seoul, South Korea. And we'll hear about the challenges he faces today living with chronic fatigue syndrome. But first, NPR News. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in for Charity Nebbe. And today my guest is Andy Douglas. He's written a memoir called The Curve of the World, Into the Spiritual Heart of Yoga. Now, Andy's a longtime Iowan, but he spent several really interesting, fascinating years in East Asia. And we're going to explore what he did there. Now he's back in Iowa, he has been, and for some years. Andy, welcome.
Thanks, Dennis.
Program. You ended up going to Thailand. Now, the idea was to take part in the meditation organization called Ananda Marga,
yes.
And you call this AM for short.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people probably haven't heard of it. Could you give us the background?
Sure. It's a spiritual organization that teaches meditation and yoga exercises, and really, it has a sort of comprehensive approach to life. There's a code of morality that you're asked to follow and a certain philosophy of life. But one of the things that really drew me to this path was the equal emphasis on service and social justice. A lot of meditation groups seem to just focus on internal growth and internal experience, but this particular one was very engaged in social action in India and in other parts of the world, starting schools and clinics and, working for structural changes in the world.
Now, this is not a religious organization. This is not Buddhism and it's not Hinduism. There's no God there's no special God.
It's a great question. Yoga is not a religion per se. It's sort of nested into the Indian spiritual tradition. I wouldn't say that it's Hinduism and it's not Buddhism, but it has some elements of Hinduism just because it comes out of that culture. But that being said, the goal of yoga has always been spiritual development. And if you look at the philosophy, it does spell out the idea of the sacred or a supreme being. And the goal of yoga is to come closer to that spiritual reality. So it kind of depends on how you spin it. I don't call it a religion per se because it doesn't have a certain set of dogmas or beliefs that you have to adhere to. It's much more about the practice, the personal practice. But, you know, religion comes from the root verb to yoke or to become one with, which is what yoga is all about. So there is a link there.
Well, anyway, you decided, and you were still in your 20s.
Yeah.
You decided, how old exactly?
I guess I was 21 when I left Texas. Yeah.
And you grew up in Texas.
Well, for the previous 10 years I'd been in Texas. Before that in Iowa, actually.
And where in Iowa?
Gibson. Have you heard of
no,
it?
No, I haven't.
It's a town of about 80 people in Keokuk County, I believe.
In Keokuk County.
Yeah.
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 Well, anyway, so you're in Texas, and you decide to become a monk.
Well, it took a while for that decision to be made. I went to Asia, and I spent 7 years there ultimately, and it was about year four that I made that decision. So I was going through a lot of changes and a lot of growth those first 3 years that I was in Asia.
But anyway, Ananda Marga is based on one man, Prabhat Ranjan Sarkar, and his philosophy and his teachings.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's based on him, but he's certainly the propounder of the philosophy, and he was the main teacher while he was alive. But the basic idea was that anyone can embrace these practices. You don't need an intermediary between you and God. You know, there was a lot of respect and love for him, but the practice is one of personal individual growth. So it's not like a cult of personality per se.
I see. But there wouldn't be any AM, they call it AM for short, without the man.
I guess that's right.
Sarkar.
That's right. Yeah.
Who died in
1990.
In 1990.
Yeah.
You say in your book he was deeply interested in the connection between spirituality and social justice, quoting from your chapter one, in the early 70s, critical of the Indian government for its inability to address the country's crippling poverty. He put forward an ambitious agenda geared toward restructuring the economy. So it's more of a social reformer almost than a spiritual leader, but I'm probably both, I'm sure.
I would say equal parts of both, yeah. Yeah, very dynamic figure. Not only a spiritual teacher and a social reformer, but he was a writer and a philosopher, a linguist, and a composer as well. He composed over 5,000 songs. So he was this amazing personality.
And interestingly enough, I noticed that, I mean, the music, his music, was one of the main reasons you loved him so much and were so decided to sacrifice your life for those years. The songs, now I will be listening to some of the music this hour, but how would you describe his music?
I would say that they're mystical songs. They're songs that describe the mystic's desire for communion with something beyond. They're quite deep songs. There's a lot of metaphor. They're very heart-touching. I just fell in love with them. Beautiful melodically. And very interesting poetically as well.
And were you able to sing yourself? I mean, you did sing a lot, right?
Yes, yes. After some time, I studied the Bengali language. And as a matter of fact, when I came back to Iowa, I was able to study it here at Iowa in a special program. And because I wanted to help translate some of the lyrics into English. They have been translated, but I wanted to help polish the language a little bit. So... yeah, I was really pulled to both the music and the language of the songs.
Well, anyway, Andy, your first destination in once you decide to follow AM and to find out what it's about and eventually to become a monk, your first place you went to was Taiwan, right? Then you went
Thailand,
but didn't you land?
You said Taiwan.
Didn't you land in Taiwan at the airport?
Oh, it's true. For about 6 hours, I was
okay,
in Taiwan.
So 6 hours.
Yeah, right.
I got that right.
You did.
But on your way to Thailand.
Yes.
And that was a new experience for a Texan/Iowan to experience that nation. What are your memories?
Well, it was fantastic. It was surprising. It was shocking. You know, I'd never, although I was born in Brazil, I don't have any memories of Brazil. So this was really my first experience of a developing country. And so foreign, you know, the language, I couldn't wrap my head around the language. But, and the food was fantastic, these exotic fruits. I just threw myself into the experience and tried to embrace it and really enjoyed my first months there in Bangkok.
Well, you grew up as the son of a Christian minister,
Presbyterian
right. minister in Texas. And you had a lot of, just from reading your book, you had some problems relating to your father. Your father really ultimately never quite understood what you were doing in the Far East.
Fair to say, yeah.
Yeah, so why did you not pursue... your father's line of being involved in a Christian sort of profession?
It's another great question. And, you know, there are a number of reasons to that. I think part of it was simply youthful rebellion, you know. Mm-hmm. I was going through a period where I wanted to rebel against my family and what they stood for. But also, I didn't feel what I hoped to feel in that particular religious tradition. And maybe I didn't give it enough of a chance. Now that I'm much older, I think probably I was pretty judgmental at that point in time. But, you know, I wanted, maybe I couldn't articulate it at the time, but I wanted something deeper in my spiritual life. And I wasn't feeling it in the church. So I began to move away from that tradition.
You write, again, quoting from your book, "There seemed to be no real rites of passage in my world, no means to understand what it was to become whole." Mm. A lot of confusion in those teenage years and into your 20s.
Yeah.
Is your father still alive?
He passed a few years ago.
Did he ever come to terms with your turning away from Christianity?
Well, he was not happy about it, especially in the earlier years. I think maybe once I came back to the States, over time, although we didn't talk much about it, I think maybe he came to appreciate my journey a little bit more. It's hard to say because we didn't speak about these things a lot.
Well, I want to go out with this segment and to remind listeners, I'm speaking with Andy Douglas, his memoir called The Curve of the World into the Spiritual Heart of Yoga. He was a monk in Thailand, Korea, also in Korea. He now lives in Iowa City. But music was a big part of his guru's life, Prabhat Ranjan Sarkar. A CD comes with the book, Andy, or is that a separate thing?
It's a separate purchase.
Well, that's all right. let's go out with some music. One of the songs of Sarkar. Do you have a selection you'd want?
Okay.
So we'll go out for this segment with what, Andy?
This is a track called Narayan Hey Narayan, track number 4 on the CD.
Talk of Iowa back in a minute on Iowa Public Radio.
To me, Ama Priyo, Shabha Priyo, Narayan. To me, Ama Priyo, Shabha Priyo, Narayan. Narayan, hey Narayan, Narayan. Acha shaba shate oto prote ubashiya tanuman. Acha shaba shate oto prote ubashiya tanuman. Narayan he Narayan, Narayan. Ratre dine anu dhyane Ratre dine.
Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe, speaking with Iowa City and Andy Douglas. For some years in the 80s and into the 90s, he lived in East Asia as a monk following Ananda Marga. Andy, AM for short, is mostly about not only music and compassion and service, but yoga. Now, people think of yoga as just sort of a physical, sort of not exercise, but a physical activity that has certain benefits, but it's more than that.
It is. It's not just tying your body into pretzels.
Okay.
I do see in this culture, to a degree, a perception of yoga as something akin to aerobic or a physical exercise, something to strengthen yourself or tone your body. And while the physical exercises of yoga can have those benefits, those are not the original intentions of yoga. There's a lot more going on there. I mean, the physical exercises of yoga called asanas can be used to cure certain illnesses, to make the body healthier, with the ultimate goal of spiritual growth. So when one says yoga, one is talking not just about physical exercises, but about meditation, about a philosophy, about a way of life, really. So I wanted to expand on that idea that some people have, that yoga is only the physical exercise.
How long has yoga been around? I mean, this goes back to the ancient times.
That's a disputed question, but 5,000 or more years, probably.
And do people practice it in the same way it was practiced long ago?
I think it's always evolving, and especially in the last century since it came to this country, it's changed quite a lot. But there are some fundamental similarities to the yoga that was practiced many, many eons ago.
Well, let's continue with your journey. You were started in Thailand, and you were there how long?
Well, I was there for at least 6 months, and then I began to travel a little bit. I went down to Malaysia and Singapore, and I began to hear more about the headquarters of AM in India that were in Calcutta, and I began to hear stories from people passing through Bangkok about Sarkar and the work that was going on there, and I was really intrigued. So eventually, after 6 or 7 months, I decided to go to India and see for myself.
And to try to meet Sarkar.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You call him Baba
yeah.
in the book. Now, this is sort of
It's an affectionate name. It means like beloved teacher or something like that.
So when did you decide you really wanted to meet him in person? Because this is not easy to meet him.
Yeah.
He was just swarmed
with...
He was busy and swarmed with fans
right.
outside his house
right.
all the time.
Yeah.
But I think, I'm guessing in Thailand, you became attached to his music and probably wanted to see him at some point.
Yeah, well, also because of the service and social justice work that he was doing and promoting, I really felt... I wanted to get to know more about who this person was, and there were stories of his, you know, of his powers, healing powers, that kind of thing, circulating. He just seemed like a very fascinating figure, and I didn't have any expectations. I just wanted to find out more, and see what would happen.
At any rate, you are in India, in Calcutta, and he lived in Calcutta then, right?
Right.
You had been there for some time, and at one point, well, tell the story.
This is the look story.
The look story where he where he looked at you
yeah.
in a most penetrating, meaningful sort of way. But
yeah,
could you set that up for us? How that happened?
That was really the moment that I understood there was something very special and profound about this person in India, and I imagine in many other traditions as well. There's this idea of, in Sanskrit it's called darshan, which means to see, and it kind of implies an exchange of energy between the people who are looking into each other's eyes. There are a lot of stories about teachers and masters who energize their followers just through one glance, and I had this experience with Baba. I was outside of his house, and... you know, it was exciting to be there. There was a lot of work going on and service and feeding of the poor was going on every day. And the songs were being composed. That was very interesting. But I didn't really get what he was all about yet in terms of a spiritual teacher. And with this look, he sort of turned one day and out of the corner of his eye looked into my eyes. And it's the only thing I can say is kind of like what we understand mystics to experience. It was an altered state of consciousness that I went into. I felt very much at peace, very joyful, just from a brief glance into his eyes. And it was kind of life-changing at that moment. It was very transformative. It sounds strange, especially to a Western listener maybe, but he kind of zapped me,
yeah.
zapped my soul, you know, and it felt wonderful. It felt very deep.
How far away were you from him when this occurred?
It was maybe 10 feet or
okay.
8 feet or something like
okay,
that.
Okay, I was thinking you're further further away.
Yeah.
And what was the duration of this glance?
Because I was kind of going into another state, it's hard to tell, but I imagine it was not long, you know, a couple of seconds probably. And after that, I just kind of floated away down the street. You know, I didn't want to talk to anybody. I felt so wonderful, so blissful, you could say, that I really wanted to hold on to that.
Well, eventually, Andy, you get to meet him in person. You had an appointment,
yeah.
I guess you could say,
yeah.
with him. And that's, was it that same house?
It was. Yeah, it was.
And how later, a year later or something? Or
Within a year, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you get that personal appointment with him?
Well, you could sign up for it. You could apply for it. And I heard so many wonderful stories from people who had spent a little time with him that it was something I wanted to experience. So I applied, and after some time, I was able to meet with him.
Talking to Andy Douglas, his memoir is called The Curve of the World, Into the Spiritual Heart of Yoga. He lives in Iowa City. We're talking about his time with practicing Ananda Marga, or AM. So tell us what happened that day and what transpired and what the conversation was like with with Prabhat Ranjan Sarkar.
Well, I won't go into too much detail, actually. I felt that he really understood me. I had come a few years previously out of a very dark emotional period. I'd been struggling a lot in my life right before I went to Asia. And the meditation was beginning to sort of lift that veil that I felt was on my life. But I felt like he really understood where I was coming from and understood something about my past just from seeing me. He asked me to do something. He asked me to become involved in service. He said, serve the suffering humanity. Those were his words. And I kind of read this as a way for me to move even further away from out of the darkness of my past and really contribute something to the world, you know? So I was ready to go out and really do some serious service.
You had spent, you know, years, I'm sure, thinking about your life, and
mm-hmm.
You were angry at some things and a lot of introspection, and when you were younger, some, I'm sure, depression mixed into the whole thing,
yeah.
of your life. And in a way, was he trying to tell you just to don't focus on yourself so much, but to get out there, do good, and focus on anything else except yourself?
I think so, yeah. And I think that's a very important lesson, you know, because it's so easy to become bogged down in one's own problems, you know, and think that that's the whole world. But really, the solution, it seems to me, and what he seemed to be saying was, you know, let go of your small preoccupations, do something for someone else, and move beyond the scope of your limited perception of yourself. And, you know, and things work themselves out, you know.
Now, he spoke no English.
Oh, he spoke probably 100 languages.
He spoke 100 languages?
Yeah, he spoke many languages, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So he spoke to me in English.
He spoke to you in English?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize. I didn't realize that
he was quite an erudite person. Yeah,
yeah. Well, anyway, so did you take his advice?
Well, I did. I wanted to become more involved in the social justice work that AM was doing, and so the opportunity arose for me to go to Tokyo and work in an office there on an English language newspaper, which was focused on some of these social and economic ideas. So I jumped at that opportunity. I spent 2 years in Japan, again, living with monks in Thailand. I'd been living with monks and slotting myself into their routine with the meditation, the yoga, the food. And that had really had an impact on me. And now I was doing that even more. So in retrospect, I can see that I was slowly moving in that direction towards towards the decision of becoming a monk myself.
Okay, so 2 years in Tokyo.
Mm,
and
yeah.
Did you like living there?
Yes and no. I was in Tokyo, which is a very frenetic, fast-paced, materialistic kind of place. The energy is a little bit heavy in Tokyo. for someone trying to do meditation, and also for someone experimenting with celibacy. There's a chapter in the book about that. As someone who is considering becoming a monk, I was experimenting with celibacy because as a monk I would become celibate. And there's so many beautiful women in Tokyo. So it was a challenge, you know. I write about that as well in the book. Once I was able to get out into the countryside of Japan, it was so beautiful, and I really fell in love with the culture. There's a real simplicity. The spiritual traditions there are wonderful. A real sense of ecology, you know. So it's kind of there's a real dichotomy in Japan between the fast-paced, high-tech world of Tokyo and some other places.
You write, "And on good days, I suspected that the joy of dedication to something greater than my own needy self would more than make up for the loss of intimate connections." So
yeah.
At that point in your mind, I think you had already pretty much, you were deciding to become a monk.
Thinking,
you would have to go through
it.
Training.
Right.
But you would have to come to grips with celibacy.
Right.
That was, I'm sure, a challenge to a certain extent.
It was, but I have to say that these particular spiritual practices, the meditation, they're they're very wonderful little things. I really felt that the idea behind this meditation is that you're taking energy from certain negative tendencies in yourself, like anger. You know, I don't want to use the word negative, but tendencies that take us away from the ability to have more love and compassion for people, and transmuting those through the meditation process. So I found that it wasn't ultimately that difficult to become celibate once I took the plunge, as long as I was serious about the meditation and about the discipline.
So you eventually left Tokyo. Next, on the way to the Philippines, and this was to go through the formal training.
Yes.
I want to call it training.
It was training.
To become a monk, which
yes.
took a year or something?
It took a year, yeah.
That was not fun. I gather
it was fun.
It was
and challenging, very very challenging as well. Yeah, I mean the physical surroundings were difficult. You know,
and you had a teacher.
Yeah, the trainer, the head monk there, very wise guy who sort of set the tone for us and guided us in ways that we needed it. But you know, it was there were about 30 young men. And we were all doing a lot of meditation. It was a small, not a small space, but, you know, relatively speaking, we're all there together in one area. There was a lot of opportunities for stepping on people's toes, you know. And so, you know, there was a lot of arguments and difficulties between the trainees, which apparently is par for the course. You know, that's part of the training is to work out those rough edges and learn how to live in simplicity and work with other people well.
And did everybody make it through the training?
No. There were, I think it was, I have a percentage in the book and I don't recall what it is now, but there's a certain percentage that would not make it through the training, maybe 30% or something like that.
You had certain fasting days and you were, I'm sure, up at 3 o'clock in the morning or something.
Four. Man. We squeezed out as much sleep as we possibly could. But 4 was – or 4:30 was when we usually got up, yeah.
Well, anyway, you make it through. What is your title at that point?
Well, the Sanskrit name for monk in this tradition is called Acharya.
Acharya, yeah.
Acharya means one who teaches by example. So at that point, I was an Acharya. I was qualified to teach the meditation, yoga practices.
Okay, so as an Acharya, you were waiting for your assignment, I guess.
I would be posted in a particular place of the world, yes.
And the place they chose to send you to was not a really easy place to be because within Ananda Marja, it's not a very large group of followers in Seoul, South Korea.
It was South Korea.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Also, that was in 88, 89, 90, around there, and the country was undergoing martial law. It was a real crackdown on there were a lot of student activists, et cetera, but the army was really trying to control things. So it made for a very interesting dynamic in the society at the time.
Well, let's take another break, and let's go out with some more music from the CD that has the hymns of Sankar.
How about number 9?
Does it have a title?
Tomari Pritite.
We'll do that, and we'll be back in a minute with Andy Douglas, his memoir, The Curve of the World into the Spiritual Heart of Yoga. This is Talk of Iowa.
Tomari Pritite Gora Tomari Kitite Pora Tomari Pritite Gora Tomari Kitite Pora Se Shriti Anjo Amori Moramo Uttelo Kora Se Shriti Anjo Amori Moramo Uttelo Kora She hashi kore je uman she bashi kore shamo She hashi kore je uman she bashi kore shamo She rage pore anurage she take hoya ponha Shirage pore anurage shirage hoya ponha.
Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe, and Andy Douglas is my guest. He lives in Iowa City, but for some years in the 80s into, 1990. Into 1990, he was in Eastern Asia as a monk for Ananda Marga, following the teachings of Prabhat Ranjan Sarkar. And just a minute ago, he's arriving in Seoul, Korea as an acharya, full-fledged monk. And you had your work cut out for you then at that point.
Yes.
What did you do first?
One of the things, besides teaching meditation, that we wanted to do was really sort of build a base for Ananda Marga in Korea, which meant to expand the membership, have some more concrete resources, like our own building or our own land, something like that. So at one point, we were looking for some land to build a retreat center, and we were successful in finding that. We also got involved in various service projects. We were working with people at an old folks' home for a while, making sure they had the supplies they needed and the company they needed. I was the regional secretary in South Korea, so that meant that I had to travel all over the country and oversee different projects. Not that there was a lot going on at that point, but we were trying to get things going. And so I would travel from Seoul down the peninsula to Daegu and Busan, to Jeonju, to the various cities where there were members. And we would have meditations and talk about what projects we could get off the ground. And it was pretty exhilarating way of life, but it was also exhausting. So I had to, at some point, be a little careful. My health had been problematic for about a year, and so it began to get increasingly worse while I was in Korea, unfortunately.
So what was going on with your health? You were just becoming fatigued, really fatigued? And
well, while I was in Asia, and I think maybe the genesis was in India, I came down with several so-called travelers or missionary diseases. I had hepatitis, which really threw me for a loop, and intestinal parasites and some other infections. And the cumulative effect of that was to sort of wear down my immune system, and it never completely rebounded. So I was entering a period of a lot of fatigue and getting sick around that time, yeah.
Did you ever see a physician about this?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay, but your ultimate diagnosis was not made until you got back to the U.S.,
Yeah.
But we can talk about that in a minute.
Sure.
But in the meantime, you were just getting run down. Yeah. A lot of demands on you, and you were finding you just didn't quite have the energy. At one point, you had heard that Sarkar was maybe ailing, nobody was quite sure what was going on, but you heard that he was in the hospital, and you were wanting to get back to India to see him maybe one last time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you had some really huge difficulties getting back into India because the Indian government was not pleased with Sarkar and his devotees.
Yeah.
And you were basically on a blacklist with Indian immigration, but you managed to get in.
I did.
Very devious.
Oh, don't say devious.
Okay. Let me say creative. Creative, right. Tell us the story.
Well, there had long been some antagonism toward the organization from the Indian government. Sarkar had been very critical of the Indian government on many counts. So there was no love lost there. I think they felt threatened maybe by some of his ideas. In any event, one thing the government tried to do, was to deport Western members of Anandamarga if they found them. So I was actually deported at one point and found myself on the blacklist. And so one way to get around that was to enter into India at a very small port, because supposedly they didn't have the same computer hookup, et cetera. So I tried to do that. It didn't quite work out. You'll have to read the book to find out what happened.
Okay.
But I did make it into India. I was able to sort of sneak into India. Yeah, and was able to go to the center near Calcutta and spend some time there one last time.
Were you able to see him?
That time, no. As a matter of fact, he had gone into the hospital, so wasn't able to.
So it was a chance at least to connect with your old friends.
Indeed,
In Calcutta.
Right, yeah.
Calcutta would be the spiritual center of AM, right?
In a sense, actually, one of the projects that Sarkar had proposed was to start communities, rural communities, centers of service and learning throughout India and actually throughout the world. So where we went that time was one of these main rural sustainable communities away from the hustle and bustle of Calcutta.
Well, you go back to Seoul, and at some point you decide that this is just not going to work. I think you're obviously still dedicated to your mission, but your health is not cooperating. And when did you decide that you needed to take a break and come back to the United States?
It was in 1990, and I came back. I had some work to do in the U.S. as well. I came back to visit my family, and it was then I learned that they were very unhappy with my choice to become a monk. And I can certainly understand that, because the monk's life is very difficult, but it's also a life basically of separation. You don't see much of your family. And that's a hard thing for any parent to wrap their head around. I probably could have been more sensitive to that point. But I certainly understand their concern and their feeling about it.
Did Anandamarga have any followers in the U.S. where you could have stayed here closer to your family?
Generally, people are posted in countries other than their home country so that you can get that sort of cultural exchange thing going on. So I'm not sure how that would have worked, but I guess it would have been possible, yeah.
But your dad decides at one point to take you to some counselors to speak about, as if you had been brainwashed. These were counselors similar. I don't know. What was the name?
Exit counselors is what they're
called. Okay, exit counselors. Yeah. And you realized what he was doing.
Yeah.
And you appreciated, I guess, on one side his concern for you, but you also realized that the counselor's message was nothing even came close to what you believed. But you did it for your dad.
Basically, yeah. That was a difficult weekend, and my health was increasingly poor. I realized that my parents were not, you know, that I would really be breaking their heart if I went back to Seoul. And, you know, listening to these counselors, I started to think in a slightly different way about my commitment. Not that it became any less, but I could see how my parents understood it. And so I decided to stay in the States at least for a little while and try and improve my health at that point.
The counselors were trying to convince you that AM was a cult.
Yeah. Basically,
I mean, that they're paid to do this, for a lot of different individuals in different situations.
Yeah, and that argument did not hold water for me. I considered it, you know. I agreed to consider their arguments, and that I had gained so much, I had grown so much, and I had learned so much from my experiences that I knew that, you know, this was not an unhealthy organization. Now, it did have, as in any organization, there were problems and there were people who did stupid things. And, you know, there were certainly downsides to it. But I didn't and I do not still see the validity of that argument.
Well, you were still, I'm sure you were torn about whether to go back at this point. You wanted to feel better.
Yeah.
And so you spent some time with your sister in Fort Dodge, Iowa.
Yeah.
And she was a little bit more supportive of you than your father. So where do you go from there?
Well, one thing that happened was that Sarkar died just weeks.
Yes. And forgive me, I was going to mention that you were in the United States when you heard of his death.
Yeah.
How did that affect you?
I was pretty overwhelmed with sadness. You know, this was a person who had committed himself to service and to uplifting others, and he was a remarkable person. I sort of modeled my life after him in a way, and it was a great loss. So I was very sad at that point. I think that maybe fed into my decision a little bit later to decide to not go back to Seoul, but to leave my chairmanship and stay in the U.S.
How did the organization cope with Sarkar's death? Was there fissures or splits within the organization?
For the first 10 years, it did very well because he was such a great organizer that he had really set things up in a very good way. You know, after some time, people had arguments about the best direction for the organization, and I'm sure that desire for power probably played into something. So there was a split after some time, and that's something that is yet to be resolved. I hope it will be resolved at some point.
Well, one thing you certainly wanted to accomplish was to get your health improved. You're still greatly fatigued, maybe a little bit better because you were getting more rest, and you weren't working as an active monk in mm-hmm. Iowa. But you end up in Iowa City at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And why did you decide to make that appointment at UIHC to see what was really going on with your health?
Well, I tried actually many different avenues to improve my health, both Western medicine and alternative medicine. I was open to any possibilities. So as a part of that, I went in to see this immunologist, and he was good. He was very open to what was going on with me. Ultimately, he gave me the diagnosis of chronic fatigue immune dysfunction syndrome, which is really just kind of an umbrella term for covering a lot of different illnesses or conditions where people find themselves unremittingly tired. So it wasn't really certainly wasn't a cure, but in a way it was helpful to have a diagnosis because it helped me to sort of frame the illness for myself and others.
So what did he tell you to do? I mean, there really isn't
sleep.
But this affects chronic fatigue syndrome, affects many, many people.
It does.
It's really common at this point. There really isn't a cure for it.
Right.
There's no medication
for it.
Did he prescribe anything?
No. I found that Western medicine's diagnosis skills were very useful in sort of figuring out what the condition was, but they didn't really have a lot to offer in terms of treatment. And so I went back to some alternative treatments. And for the past 2 or 3 years, I've been working with a Chinese doctor taking some Chinese herbal medicine, and that seems to be helping quite a bit. It's a mysterious situation to have chronic fatigue because it's all about energy, and that energy can just disappear like that, or it can build up and you can feel like you have a lot of energy. Where does it go? Where does it come from? I'm always very fascinated by that question. But these Chinese herbs at least have been, I think, they're designed to build energy within the body. And for me, at least, it's helping a little bit. I still get quite tired, but I think I'm not as bad as I used to be.
Is it where you have, you feel this great one day and you have lots of energy and then it just kind of quickly dissipates? Is that how it works?
The thing that almost always happens is that I feel energy and I'm like, hey, I'm cured. And I'll go out and do a lot of stuff, And then I overdo things and the energy gets sapped. So I have to be very careful about sort of pacing myself, not taking too much on at one time. I learned that was one of the lessons of this illness is setting boundaries and pacing myself.
Yeah. Well, you went on to get a master's in University of Iowa and doing well today. We just have a minute left. Andy, looking back at this time as a monk for AM, your really fascinating life you led in Eastern Asia, many different locations and many interesting people, eventually meeting Prabhat Sarkar. What's the overall meaning that this gave to your life, these years as a monk, these years in Asia?
Yeah. Well, for me, they were completely transformative. I don't know what my life would be like now if I had not gone to Asia. I really can't comprehend what it would be like. But it gave me a real sense of purpose in my life. It gave me a way to connect with the world around me. It gave me a way to deepen my experience in the world and open my heart, develop a sense of compassion for others. It was just a wonderful period in my life that has shaped who I am in so many different ways, and I continue to embrace the outlook of yoga, which is to see all things as sacred and to love all beings and to serve them. I think that's a great motto. That's a great way to live one's life. And I'm just really grateful that I had the opportunity to come onto this particular path.
Well, Andy Douglas, thanks so very much. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank
you, Dennis.
You
worked for Iowa Public Radio as a student assistant.
Years ago.
Quite a long time ago.
Yes.
But it was great to see you again.
And, yeah. You too, Dennis.
Enjoyed the book very much. My guest today, Andy Douglas, his memoir, The Curve of the World into the Spiritual Heart of Yoga. Had help today, technical support today from Ben Stanton, Talk of Iowa, and our talk show team's executive director is Catherine Perkins. And for Charity Nebbe, I'm Dennis Reese. Bali are poti ve chamudra kina shubanare ka pore bondu shubanare ka pa shetai jakan shurjo otte akasha garange pote shetai jakan sujo ote akasha garange pote moner maje sheirang jagai moner maje sheirang jagai ananda apa ananda apa shubanare ka pare bondu shubanare ka pare.
Rajupadam.